Blog Talk Radio.
Real life. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages. I always love that intro. Anyway, hey, check this out. This is Billy Blade, and this is the Biggest Little Show on radio. And my guest today, he is the cruiser great. He is the first cruiserweight champion of the modern generation. We bring to you TJ Perkins, a.k.a. TJP. TJP, are you on air tonight?
Hey, what's going on, guys?
TJ, how's everything going, man? How are you? How's life right now? I know it's very crazy right now. How's things going with you today? And life in general.
Pretty much same as usual. Pretty much same as usual, I guess.
You're a pretty busy guy, though, even if you're not. Yeah, are you in? Yeah, I was going to ask you. Are you in? Last I talked to you, I thought you were in Vegas. Are you in Los Angeles now?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't really been quarantining or anything. I've been traveling and doing pretty much normal stuff. So I'm actually in Los Angeles
now. Are you? Okay, cool. Yeah, so the beach is closed tomorrow, that's what I'm hearing. So I guess a bunch of people went to the beach and all of a sudden they're closing it. Go figure, right? So, hey, I've known you for a long time. I started at the School of Hard Knocks, and when I remember training and whatnot, I remember there was a split between Jesse Hernandez and Bill Anderson. And I remember hearing about you back then. And you were called the Pinoy Boy back in the day, if I recall.
Yeah.
when I knew you back in the day, I've known you for a long time. I consider you one of the greatest wrestlers out there today. Even back then, you grew up, you started at a really young age. Where did you actually train at? I thought I heard that you didn't train actually at the School Hard Knocks. You started somewhere else and then end up at Bill's or Jesse's. So can you let the people listening know where you started out at and whatnot?
Yeah, I did start out at Bill and Jesse's, but, you know, from the jump, I mean, for the most part, I was never really satisfied with just, like, being in any one spot. So, you know, at that time, I guess generationally speaking, You know, you had places around the Los Angeles area like Gil's Garage or, you know, places like that.
Yeah.
Martin Marin had a had his own place in Anaheim, obviously with WPW and then soon after that UPW, which became a developmental territory for WWF at the time. You know, so there were different places like that where you could kind of you know, just get some gym time in and just any place that opened up a ring for me, I would go. So, but for the most part, you know, the Hard Knocks and Bill and Jess, that was always like really like the first place and really kind of like the home base for me.
Yeah, and like and that's what I remember when I started hearing your name. I mean, you were everywhere back. You know, there wasn't tons of companies like there is now. You know, so back then there was only a select handful of you know, independent companies in Southern California and Northern California. So like, I heard somewhere, you know, I know that Kevin Quinn. I heard something about Kevin Quinn being somebody that was one of your trainers, and I remember seeing back in the day again Bill and Jesse. I had a similar. I was training at Jesse's, but then Bill Anderson would have a training on Saturdays from 3 to 6. So I would do Jesse's in the morning and do Bill's and you know in the afternoon. And I remember guys like Los Cubanitos, you know, Reyes and Romero, you know. And are you still? Aren't you real close with them? Weren't they like some of the guys that helped you guys all came up together? Correct.
Yeah, I mean that's definitely like a big brother little brother dynamic. With me. In fact, I was just, you know, talking to somebody about Rocky the other day. They had asked me about, you know, just my experience coming up with them. And, you know, they came in a couple years before me. We were all like late 90s generation guys. And yeah, I mean, I definitely kind of had that like little brother, like sort of position with them. You know, I mean, obviously still am like the younger of the group and just always kind of followed them around and like followed their lead on a lot of stuff. And a lot of what I still have today and a lot of what people kind of see in me as far as like my qualities as a performer or whatever, you know, for the most part, a lot of that I got from them.
Yeah, and you know the Ricky and Rocky, they were in the classes when I started at Jesse's in 99, you know, and they were part of the classes and Kazarian and even the guys like Crazy KC and you know KG Sakota are in all those guys, you know, so it was really good classes and the Cubanitos them and they've been doing it, they've been going strong for 20, you know, two decades now, and I think they both are still working pretty hard just like yourself, correct? They're both in some of the top companies out there. So Rocky is
absolutely
obviously doing amazing. So.
Yeah. Rocky definitely has the most hats out of all of us. You know, he's very much, he was always kind of like destined, I think, to be an administrator of some kind. Cause he was always like in those sort of positions. Like even when we were younger, you know, he was always like kind of managing a lot of things behind the scenes. He always had like a pretty good mind for business and things like that. So he was always halfway destined to kind of end up behind the desk in a way. I still think he's one of the best, you know, performers in the world. But you know, he's definitely, started to kind of become really well-rounded as far as like having so many different contributions to the business. And obviously he's got a really important role now with New Japan Pro Wrestling. And, I've since returned to New Japan Pro Wrestling as well. And then Ray is like, he's as busy as probably as he's ever been. You know, he's never really stopped. He's a lot like me in the sense of being like a real globetrotter. And he's always been like the wrestler of like the group. I mean, as far as like, especially with the duo, like Rocky was always more of the entrepreneur. And Reyes was always kind of like if Arn Anderson was the he was like the Arn Anderson of that duo for sure. Like, you know, if that's the best way to define it.
Totally. Yeah. You know what? I remember Ricky, we were training one time at Jesse's and I remember like, you know, when you're first training, obviously you don't, I mean, I just like anybody else, I didn't know what I'm doing. Of course, I probably still don't know, who knows, but I remember he was very, very particular on the training. Like he was very hard on the guys, but no, in a great way though. And I feel like a lot of schools kind of lack that, I think, aggression that I remember that Ricky and even Rocky and guys like that were really, you know, really hard in a good way because they wanted to show you the right way, you know, and I do remember that a lot, and I do appreciate being in classes with him. He definitely was I learned a lot from the Cubanitos, you know, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let me ask you, so this radio show, I kind of go off the fly. I try to get a couple notes. I just I've known you a long time, and you've done so much in the business, and although you're very humble and whatnot, you have done so much in the business. I mean, what was it like? What was some of your favorite? Because, I mean, in your first couple years, you were wrestling all over the western states, if I remember right, California, Nevada, Arizona. But you were wrestling in Mexico within the first couple years, too. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I would kind of bounce around across the border a lot. A lot of my first stuff that I was doing was that, like, you know, crossing Tijuana, Mexicali, and stuff like that. And then a few years later, after New Japan had recruited me, they ended up sending me to Mexico City. So I lived there for, like, 2003 was basically, like, my year in Mexico City. And I was full-time for CMLL at the time. And it was pretty natural transition because I had already been over, you know, for, like, border shows. So I kind of knew what to expect from, like, the culture as far as that standpoint. But yeah, I mean, a lot of my early years, there was a lot of Mexican wrestling involved.
Now, weren't you related to a masked wrestler named Puma back in the day? Wasn't that somebody that you were related to? And you guys were, like, came up at the same time, and I think, if I recall, I'm trying to remember that. Is that right?
related to as in it's me? Yes, absolutely. There's, like, God, I want to say 10 or 12 different, like, masked characters that I've done over the years. That was, like, the first real prominent one. I mean, obviously, like, I was masked when I first got in, so, like, there's that. I mean, like, Pinoy Boy, but that was really just necessity, like, needing to cover my face because of my age. Like, they didn't even have, like, a real mask for me. Like, they would just, like, put other people's masks on me. I remember wearing Super Muñeco's mask one day, then, like, La Parka's mask another day, and it was just, like, whatever they had, they would just needed to cover me up, so.
Yeah, because, I mean, what I meant to say it earlier, what age did you start training? Wasn't it pretty pretty young, wasn't it?
Yeah, 13 years old.
13 years old, I mean, that's a typical luchador right there, so. You were destined to go to Mexico at one point or another. I mean, geez, were you even over 18 when you were actually wrestling in Mexico? Not the first couple of years, but when you moved down, you were over 18 at that point, right?
Yeah, I had just turned 18, like, the fall right before I moved over there, like, the end of spring or something.
That's crazy. Like, and, you know, a lot of lucha, you hear a lot of stories from the top luchadors nowadays where they started like yourself at 13 years old, which is a pretty crazy thing that, you know, I mean, your whole life has been wrestling. A third of your life. I mean, two thirds of your life has been wrestling, you know, and that says a lot. That means you've been doing something right if you've been doing it for, you know, two thirds of your life, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'll end up having that, like, Jerry Lawler, like years of experience on like my resume someday where it's like, you know, having spanned so many generations or whatever, but.
Yeah. I mean, you said a couple years after Cubanitos, what year did you actually start? I know 13, but what year was that?
Let's see. So I remember distinctly starting because I was trying to wrestle amateur in high school and my school didn't have a team. So I thought that was how everybody gets into pro. So I thought, okay, well, there goes my plan. Because you got to remember at the time, the internet really wasn't like a thing yet. So, like, I didn't really, you know, there was no social media. There's no, like, way to understand how this works. So I just kind of, like, would write to training gyms in, like, PWI magazine, like, that had advertisements, you know, Larry Sharp and stuff like that. Dean Malenko's school in Tampa at the time. I think Sean's school hadn't even opened yet, San Antonio, because we're talking like 1998. Yeah. So this is like the summer of 98, and I'm thinking, like summer of 98, I'm 13 years old, and I know I'm going to start high school that, you know, end of summer, fall. And so, you know, you get to that point, I'm thinking, okay, all these guys, you know, from interviews and things, you just know a lot of these guys are amateur wrestlers or football players. So I'm like, okay, well, I'm not going to go to the NFL, so I'm going to wrestle amateur and then try to do it that way. Then I walked in, like, God, August of 98 for summer school, went to the office, asked about their amateur program. They didn't have one. I said, well, I guess I got to figure out some other way. I wrote to all those other schools, and, you know, you really, at the time, you really had to be like 18 or 21 years old to go to a wrestling training gym at the time, because it wasn't really like a big, well-advertised, like regulated thing, you know, so people were a lot more careful about it, I guess.
Especially out of state, you know, and you being in Cali, you know?
Yeah, and
I'm sure of it, yeah.
Yeah, and I couldn't, yeah, obviously I couldn't relocate. All pro wrestling up north in Hayward was the closest thing as far as what I thought. So, you know, because of that, I was like, okay, well, maybe I don't have a chance to do this, but just, you know, luckily being, you know, in the Los Angeles area, like there's so much Mexican wrestling. So, you know, and there, it's like, with their culture, it's like boxing. If you're old enough to get in the ring, then, you know, they'll get you in there at any age. If you can walk, you can wrestle, is, you know, as far as they're concerned. So, you know, they let me do it
totally.
As if I was sort of born into it. And, you know, pretty soon I kind of more or less was born into it.
Yeah. I mean, 13 years old. I don't even know if you were in were you in junior high then? I'm guessing you were like 7th, 8th grade, right?
I just finished 8th grade, and then it was like my first, yeah, basically like my first week of high school, the end of summer around then, like August of 1998.
That is crazy. You might have been around as long. I think you've been around longer than I have. I think I started at Jesse's in 99. I think December of 99. I can't remember. It's what it was right there in December. I just remember Jesse's school was, you know, when you first start, just like yourself, when I first started, it was a dream. You know, I started a little later. I think I was 20 or 21 or something like that. But going into Jesse's school for the first time, seeing all the posters and seeing some of these guys you've never seen, but, I mean, they're doing stuff I never think I'd be able to do. Next thing you know, I'm doing it. You're doing it like yourself. I just remember the ceilings being so low that any time we do a suplex, every once in a while your foot goes up in the ceiling, you know. So those are always good times, you know what I mean? Bill Anderson had a really good setup. Too bad that didn't last.
The one wall you'd hit your elbow if you hit the ropes on one side,
yeah.
I remember.
And Bill had a really good setup. It just didn't last as long as I, you know, obviously people hope. But let me you know, I'm also from the Inland Empire as well, by the way. I was born, my parents, you know, we moved a lot. I was Riverside, San Bernardino, Fontana, Redlands. I kept going all over the place, you know. Eventually I moved out of the area, but I always loved the Inland Empire, you know. And I didn't know anything about, same thing with you, I didn't know anything about Jesse's school. And we didn't have internet, so I wanted to do a school. And I don't even remember how I discovered Jesse's school. All pro wrestling was the school I heard of, and I just couldn't afford it. I couldn't relocate and stuff. So I eventually found Jesse's school. It was really cool, and it was good pricing, which is great for me. I'm sure great for you when you were 13 years old, you know what I mean?
I think
being able to
do it day by day was what made it so easy, because you didn't have to, like, have, like, a long enrollment. You could just pay gym fees per day, and so it was great because you just come in and, like, you know, more or less $20 you can train for the day. So it's kind of like an old-school boxing gym in that way, because – you know, they kind of enabled you to be able to kind of just go and do your thing. You could come in, put in your time, and, you know, they weren't responsible for, like, a career. They were responsible for basically just giving you the tools for the day. So it's kind of like DIY experience. But, you know, as you were becoming a regular in the gym, obviously they would start to – I mean, just like in a boxing gym, they would, like, take people under the wing. Like, the more often you were around, obviously you became, like, a protege. So, you know, for somebody like me, it's like a gym rat. You know, I'm there, like, every single time, multiple times a day if possible. And so, like, you know, people like that, you know, you become like a protege in the gym. So everybody becomes your coach, I guess, by proxy.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and that's kind of what happened, the same with me as well. I actually paid if I recall, it was 12 sessions for, like, $120 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was really cool, you know. So I always got to mark my – my name when I showed up. I think Jesse still has his list, which is kind of cool, you know, to have that around. Ricky Reyes, I think, was one of the trainers regularly. And then, of course, Rocky, as well as Frankie Kazarian. So that was, you know, at a good class, you know, every time I was able to train there. So you learn a lot. I ended up going to Ultimate Pro Wrestling myself. So when you was working at UPW, we just had Nova on our show last week, and he was talking about his Ultimate Pro Wrestling days being some of his best days that he's ever had. What did you do at Ultimate Pro Wrestling? Were you weren't Pinoy Boy yet. Were you already Pinoy Boy, or were you something else? And what was your experience in Ultimate Pro Wrestling?
Yeah, so I debuted with that nickname, but when I got there, they, like, I remember, and I want to say, like, it was that generation of guys that, like, kind of created this, because, like, cause I think I remember, like, Kazarian and some of the guys making this joke, maybe Cena, too, but, like, a lot of the guys that were there still at the time, because I was, like, same thing, like, when I went there, it's, like, everybody's little brother, because, you know, we're talking 99, 2000, so, like, 99, 2000, 2001, those few years, they were, you know, like NXT, basically. So if you were there, it meant that you were part of WWF, after, you know, before
yeah.
WWE, I guess. And so, like, 99% of the people there were contracted talent, and then there was, like, you know, like, that 1% of, like, very few people that were just there for, you know, what other reasons, or, like, you know, they were close to it or whatever. But me being, like, a 14, 15-year-old kid during those years, I couldn't even drive. So it's not like I was ever going to be under contract to WWF at the time, because my name wasn't Mikey Henderson, and he's a freak of nature, and he was almost at 16. but, you know,
Mikey,
always,
I think Mikey's
you know,
is one of the best.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Mikey
still
was
one
amazing.
Of my heroes. So I was. It was kind of like I was there under scholarship, you know? Like, I was good enough to be there.
Yeah.
They didn't charge, I wasn't under contract, but they weren't, like, charging me enrollment. I could be on it. So it's like if you took, like, a really, really good teenager and put them on NXT. That's all it was. Like, and the guys, as a joke, they changed my name. Like, not really changed my name, but they gave me a new nickname. So it's kind of stopped calling me Pinoy Boy, and they tried to make up different meanings for what TJ would stand for. And I remember at one point, as a joke, they said it stood for Too Juicy, and that became, like, my nickname for a while when I was, like, 15. So,
and what can you say? UPW was a go-to company at that time, you know? So
anybody that comes across, like, Christopher Daniels, Kazarian, Cena, Samoa Joe, those guys, like, you could thank them for that stupid nickname.
Too Juicy. Well, when on in Ultimate Pro Wrestling, so back in the day, that's when I was training at Jesse's, I believe, whatnot. You know, they would run shows at the Galaxy, and those shows were, like, you know, those were the go-to shows. I mean, you never knew who was going to be there scouting, and I obviously started teaming up with Gangrel over those years. He was kind of under contract, kind of wasn't, and so a little funny story. Ultimate Pro Wrestling training, and I think it was Huntington Beach at the time. I can't remember, but I definitely know Tom Howard was the trainer on a Sunday night class. I had a newborn, so I wasn't able to kind of go to Jesse's classes as much as I wanted to. So Sundays was the best day. Tom Howard would actually let me in on a training, and I'd pay him under the table. And then years later, Rick Bassman, I told him about that. He's like, I had no clue, you know. He let me pay him under the table on Sunday classes, and I got to work with the developmental class on the Sunday night and the advanced class on Sunday afternoon. And like I said, Tom Howard to let me in, and I was under table. So really Rick didn't know I was training there. So I wasn't really technically part of UPW, but I used to go to all the shows and, you know, and you, like you said, developmental for WWE. So, I mean, Jim Ross is rare. I think he was there like almost every show, and, you know, you guys like Triple
right,
H
yeah.
there showing up out of nowhere, you know, I mean, it was a huge thing. And I think, it basically opened eyes to a lot of SoCal talent. I know that for sure. You know, guys that are you see on TV now are killing it. And Ultimate Pro Wrestling was definitely, you know, a good way to start. Let me ask you another question. I mean, I got stuff. I'm just kind of brainstorming. You've done a lot of stuff. So, you know, you get through Ultimate Pro Wrestling. They, unfortunately, I want to say they went out 2001, 2002. So they were,
yeah, I can't remember the year, but I know they didn't last much longer after the Galaxy show. So,
yeah,
you wrestled for a lot of other companies. I mean, you've wrestled for pretty much every company, top company that there is out there. I mean, obviously, back in the day, you did the TNA, you know, you did TNA, ROH, you even did the Major League Wrestling the first time it was out. New Japan Pro Wrestling, mm-hmm. PWG, Evolve, Dragon Gate USA, I mean, Ultimate Pro Wrestling. You also did Lucha Underground, correct?
I went in and we did, me and Pentagon did an untelevised match because they were negotiating with me to see if I'd come in for a season or two right before I went to WWE, actually. I almost didn't sign with WWE because I really wanted to do Lucha Underground. They flew me out to LA. We had a meeting. They had me in Pentagon wrestle. They sent me some follow-up stuff about, you know, what they would want to do going forward. And I was just kind of like mulling over all of that when the Cruiserweight Classic came up. And so I almost just went there instead. So, yeah, I did a little bit of Lucha Underground and then, you know, Wrestling Society X, Lucha Libre USA, pretty much everything except for, like, All Japan and Noah. Everything else.
Oh, okay,
I
so
hit.
You didn't do those. Okay. I didn't know that. Did you ask for Wrestling Society X? Did you, like, ask for your release? Like, did you, like, what did you think of that? I mean, the reason I brought that up, because it's been mentioned a lot lately.
I just never signed. I did the first.
Oh, okay, so.
I did a few things for them. Yeah, I think there was only one season, maybe two at the most. And then I did, like, the pilot. I did a couple other things. And then I think, I don't remember if we had even gotten as far as, I mean, I think there was probably an offer, and I just turned it down. Because a lot of us were either going to TNA or WWE at the time. So a lot of guys were kind of like, didn't want to stay too long. Like, obviously, like Matt Seidel, Evan Bourne, like he was on his way into WWE at the time. And I think, like, for me, like TNA, Ring of Honor, like that stuff was coming up for me. I just kind of, I think, been back from, you know, spending a couple years at New Japan and in Mexico for CMLL. So like there was new stuff for me to do. And I didn't think I was like, wanted to stay put in like a kind of an experimental project, you know? So I think I just turned it down.
It's funny, as I remember watching the first season, of course, many people off of Wrestling Society X are huge stars today. So, I mean, they had a lot of huge up and coming stars that were ends up being obviously future legends. Wrestling Society X is crazy though. I didn't realize how over the top it was until I watched it recently again. I'm like, wow.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, crazy, it was pretty crazy. Like, I was like, holy shit. I was, like, so surprised. I didn't remember it being that over the top when I watched it the first time. But then I watched it recently, some of the – I'm like, wow. I mean, Shark Tank, you know, stuff like that, you know. It was pretty – it was piranhas and stuff. It's pretty – I mean, I know what they were trying to do. They were trying to be different, and you can't knock them for that. Like I said, any – the more wrestling, the better for the boys is how I look at it. So I was hoping it worked out because a lot of SoCal guys are on that show, you know, so I was hoping for that one. Now, when you moved on to TNA, did you end up, what was your experiences like your first time in TNA and whatnot? Because, I mean, let's back up. I'm sorry. Before TNA, you were part of the New Japan Pro Wrestling Dojo, if I remember right. That was before TNA. Like, that had some of the best wrestlers in the world at that dojo in LA. Like, what were some of the guys, who were some of the guys you trained with and how was that experience and how did that guide you to basically where you are today?
Well, I mean, I pretty much owe everything to New Japan, to be honest. Like so it was all very tightly packed together. Like all of that previous stuff, you know, being in Los Angeles and doing all the local stuff, hopping the border to Mexico and doing some of that when I was a teenager. And then being in UPW at a time when it was the WWF developmental during those years, because right after, towards the tail end of that, WWF cut ties to UPW and they were no longer a developmental territory for WWF. But Rick Bassman and UPW, I mean, he's a very business-minded person. He's not just kind of like in wrestling just to play wrestling, you know. So.
Oh, he's definitely that way for sure.
Yeah, very smart guy. As far, you know, from a business standpoint, he's very, you know, sharp as far as, you know, always thinking, you know, about the business end. So he immediately pivoted towards Zero One, and they became a sister company for Zero One. Well, through that partnership is how I met the Inoki family, because Zero One was just recently split off from New Japan themselves. So it's kind of like two companies that were like just splitting off of bigger entities, and they kind of found each other. So the Inoki family was still kind of present in that Zero One partnership. They were around, and they were looking to build the first satellite gym for New Japan in Los Angeles. And so they needed to scout some talent, and they pretty much like picked their next set of, you know, New Japan junior gaijin from me and the Havana Pitbulls, basically. And they kind of picked Joe as well, but Joe was already working for Zero One, so he couldn't really – at the time, you couldn't just switch teams like that. Like, talent trading was super, super, super taboo. So, you know, he was present with us as far as, like, helping getting the gym going, and he was definitely, like, a New Japan entity, like, behind the scenes. But he never went overseas and toured with us. But that's how I got into New Japan. That was in 2002. So I spent the next couple of years like debuting for New Japan. I ended up going to the dojo in Tokyo. So like I was kind of a young boy in both of the dojos at one point or another. And then they sent me to Mexico like they would for any of the Japanese young boys, just as like an excursion to get experience. I spent, you know, 2003 in CMLL as part of New Japan. And then when I got back, I mean, it was like, going to Japan and going to New Japan and going to CMLL, it's like I like turned off my brain to professionally to everything else. It's like I didn't do anything else but those two things. So when I got home from all that, you know, there's a period in like 2004, like the end of 2003, basically, I got home from like Mexico, and it was like, if you've been around long enough, you know that period of time, that was like the indie boom. Like indie wrestling kind of didn't really exist. I mean, it existed before that, but it wasn't like indie wrestling as a label, you know, it was just wrestling.
Yeah.
It wasn't WWF. And now it was like this whole thing, like 2003, 2004, like this big independent wrestling.
ROH,
boom, it was like called
PWG.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so coming fresh off of New Japan and CMLL, like I was able to kind of walk right in the door at Ring of Honor and get right into TNA during those years. And that was like year one for those companies. Like, so
that's right.
You know, I remember doing Ring of Honor, the All Japan joint show was my debut for them back in 2003, and they were barely a year old. It was like still their first year. I remember Gabe and Rob Feinstein were still like running the ship and then Kerry, obviously, that was like the trio that was kind of doing it. And I remember meeting Rob, like that first show I did, for them at that time, that's how far back it was. And then TNA, same thing. They had just gotten off the fairgrounds. They were doing Fox. I think my first show for them was Explosion on Fox Sports, and they hadn't gotten on Spike yet. And I ended up doing the first 3-hour pay-per-view for them. And when they were first going to Spike, so it was part of their first generation as well.
Yeah, because
I have an interesting
perspective
for TNA, because like I've been part of every generation they've had.
I was going to say, because that was after they were doing that weekly thing in Tennessee, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were doing like a weekly pay-per-view, so you were talking about after that, right?
Yeah, they did that for you know, a little bit, and then they finally got that Fox Sports deal, and they were trying to get onto a proper network deal, and that's when I came in right then.
And what were you going to say about the TNA perspective, I think, or?
Oh, it's just funny, like, as I guess a side note, I guess to show how old I am, is that, like, I've been...
Oh, here we go.
I've been part of every generation that they've had there from start to current.
Yeah, no, you have, and that's why I was asking. You know, when I remember, this is... Now, were you Puma at this point, or?
Yes.
Were you doing a Puma thing, or were you?
Yeah.
So you, you end up winning the X Division title? Did you end up winning it as Puma? Because I know you did Manic, right? I think Manic was another mask character that you did.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Yeah, Suicide Manic. I didn't win the title until I was Suicide.
Okay, that's what it was. Yeah. Now, because didn't they recently bring back the Suicide character, like or at least for like a throwback show or something like that?
Yeah, Suicide Anime.
I actually always dug the character. I actually dug it. Actually, I thought it was a cool little concept. It's their own.
Yeah,
so they
it's got a really,
in it, you know.
It's got a real niche following, you know, and I think now it's become like even just past TNA, it's become part of like American wrestling culture. It's like not super famous, but like I think if you're a wrestling fan and you know you're aware of more than just WWE, especially if you're an American wrestling fan, like as far as like TNA goes, like that's part of like that's kind of like a foundational image when you think of TNA. Like if you think of TNA, you kind of think of, obviously you think of like AJ Styles, you probably think of Jeff Jarrett, you think of Abyss, probably think of Kurt Angle, and you think of the Ultimate X. And I think Suicide is another image that you kind of think of because it's just very TNA. Like it's synonymous with the company.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's what I was saying with TNA. That's him. Like, he's not going anywhere else. That's their gimmick, you know? So that's the cool thing, you know?
Yeah.
So it's good to see other, I know the multiple guys have done the character, top guys on TV that you see today, like yourself and whatnot. So it definitely was, the character was definitely in good hands. And you know, the guys like yourself really made that character. Hey, real quick, I was going to go back to the New Japan Pro Wrestling, the dojo. So the class was huge. I mean, the, you know, like yourself, you think everything, you've done, you want to thank the New Japan Pro Wrestling. What about guys? What other guys were in the class? I know Brian Danielson was in the class, the Cubanitos with Rocky and Ricky. I don't know if Ricky was there. I know Rocky Romero was there, right? What other people? Because, a gentleman, I remember.
They were still tagging at the time, yeah.
Oh, they were? Okay. Because I have a guy named, well, see, I call him Cubanitos because that's when I knew him, but they end up being the Havana Pitbulls and all that.
Me too. I always call him Cubanitos.
Yeah, I'm used to it because I don't remember that they changed their name. I always forget that. But let me ask, so there was a gentleman, see, when I first started running shows was 2002, when I started running shows, and I had a lot of top up-and-coming wrestlers, and I didn't realize how good they were until you start seeing them all over the place. There was a gentleman there that you had and I'll go to a second gentleman, but there was a gentleman there who I thought was one of the best wrestlers I've ever seen. And he just never like went places like yourself. I mean, I know he did when he was around, but he quit. I think he quit when he was about to be one of the biggest stars out there. Shooting star Bobby Quant. I thought the guy was amazing. You know, whatever happened to Bobby? I mean, I know when I worked at ATW and all that, I never really asked. Did he go to military or something? I don't remember. What happened to him?
Yeah. He came down from the Bay Area. He's from Morgan Hill, California, which is kind of near San Francisco, Oakland, that area.
Yeah.
And so he was an all-pro wrestling student. That was one of the gyms I almost went to, I wasn't close to going there, I guess, but it's one of the places I thought I would try to go when I was first trying to learn how to wrestle way, way, way back in the day. And so he came out of there and he wasn't really doing anything except for just local stuff in the Bay Area, San Francisco. And he kind of came down to, just look for an opportunity as you do. And so he got into the LA wrestling scene down south and got into the New Japan Dojo. He's really very natural grappler and wrestler. He's a fantastic amateur wrestler and an incredible submission wrestler on the mat. He has this sort of like Forrest Gump like way of like life. Like there's so many things that he's good at and wants to do with his life. So, wrestling was only going to ever be a small part of it. And he was incredibly talented at it. Obviously he didn't really have necessarily the look for it. He's kind of a frumpy, skinny little white kid. So he didn't really look like, you watch him for just a few seconds. He'll capture your imagination. He's amazing. He's just a little quiet and doesn't necessarily look like a wrestler, but he's incredible. He was my tag partner for a while. And I think it was just after spending some time in in the dojo, and then they sent him to Mexico with us, and he ended up being able to do one show at Cork and Hall, and he was already on his way out of wrestling, so I think they kind of did it as like a thank you or just like a parting gift, like to give at least have him come and work for the company before he's done. And it's just like all in like a span of a year, he went for like a WWE dark match, and you know, there's nothing going to come from it, but you know, they wanted him to be able to come in and work and do some cool stuff. And he got to do that match, went over to New Japan, worked in Corkin, and then spent the year with us in Mexico. And then I remember towards the tail end of us in Mexico, he was already knew what his plan was to join the Navy. What he wanted to do, because he wanted to be a Navy SEAL.
Wow.
He eventually became a SEAL. He's still in the Navy, and I think he's getting his medical education, so he's going to be a medical expert pretty soon. so I look forward
that's
to that.
That's amazing.
Like,
you know, and yeah, I mean, that's amazing.
Training. Yeah, you're going to be training for the Navy when we're at it, finishing up in Mexico. So I remember we would go on runs together. We would go swimming together. And he was just, you know, training to get his entry test for the Navy. And yeah, we got back, and he just kind of did like a little farewell tour on his indie dates and things. And then he joined the Navy. He lives in San Diego now. He's got a wife and kid. He's doing well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I said, we were when I ran a company when I first started 2002, I ended up joining maybe a couple years later, 2-3 years later, with All Pro Wrestling. So we had, you might remember this, because we did All Pro Wrestling San Francisco, All Pro Wrestling Central Coast, and then we had All Pro Wrestling Los Angeles. And then we had another one.
I remember.
All Pro Wrestling Central Valley. And that's when Bobby, I always saw his matches in L.A., and they were just amazing. And so I always wondered about him. I thought you would know what happened, because I hadn't heard about him in a long time. And he was one of those guys, like, I believe, like Mikey Henderson, who was just amazing, you know, and Bobby reminded me of just that story about you talking about Mikey. Now, there's another gentleman that kind of came up around the same time you did and kind of has a similar story of, you know, Japan and ROH and Major League, whatever, you know, everything you kind of done, he's kind of done in the same path. I knew him as Spanky, but everybody nowadays knows him as Brian Kendrick. Do you still keep in touch with Brian Kendrick? I know he's one of I believe he's one of the best wrestlers out there, in my opinion. I've been in a ring with a guy a few times, and he's one of the best out there, you know. And I'm glad he's still part of, you know, WWE right as we speak, you know. You have any stories about Brian Kendrick that you could tell everybody?
Yeah, it's funny that a lot of the stuff. So Brian and I really are good friends in real life, and. We did that storyline when I first came to WWE. Some of it was fabricated. He wasn't my coach, for one. Everybody always like, what was it like to train? What was he like? I'm like, I don't know, because I started wrestling before him. He wasn't my coach.
Yeah,
but he was. Yeah, he was. You know, he's older than me, so he did. He was kind of like a big brother to me, more so in life than in wrestling. But but one of the true stories from that time was he really did come and pick me up from school so we can make some indie dates on the weekend, like before I could drive. And he had just moved to LA because he got released from his developmental contract just prior to that. So we were both kind of just 4 years in. And I remember so the way I used to wrestle, like I would ditch school on like a Friday afternoon and go ride to a show on Friday night. And then, so I'd be like in, you know, Riverside or something in California, and I would ditch school, carpool with somebody to, I don't know, Las Vegas or something, and do maybe like Buffalo Gym shows or something, or Phoenix, or maybe San Francisco
old
or something
school
like that.
There.
Right?
Buffalo
so
Gym
I'd do a
shows?
Show on
wow.
Friday. Yeah. So I'd do a show on Friday, and then in the locker room, I'd just see like, okay, does anybody go into this show in like Anaheim or San Diego tomorrow on Saturday? And then be like, okay, you're going. So I'd jump in their car. So I would go carpool from there to there. And then on Saturday night, I just ask around Rock, like, okay, is anybody doing the show in Tijuana tomorrow, Sunday? Or are you doing Marketplace tomorrow? Okay, like I would just jump in their car. And then after that show on Sunday, I'd say, can anybody just get me back to Riverside and just drop me back off? I go back to school on Monday.
so
but,
you never knew
so
how
thank
you were getting
you.
There? I mean...
No,
you never knew
no.
when you're
I mean,
getting
usually,
home to hell. Okay.
mean, a lot. Well, no, a lot of times I would try to plan ahead and be like, okay, I know I can go with this guy, this guy, this guy to these shows, and I would kind of know that all week long. But there were some weeks where I would just, I wouldn't know until that night. I would just try to figure it out. Spanky would be somebody that would always offer to come pick me up on Fridays if we had the same show. So
that part of our storyline
was true. No, he had this little tiny like Honda. I don't remember what the name of it was, but it was like I forget the name, but like that one little Honda like sports car that was only two seaters and like the window was right against the back of your head.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah, they didn't make them anymore, but I forgot what they're called. I just remember his truck because he drove his truck across country, you know, back and used to sleep in it actually back in it when he first came out to Cali, you know. But
you
were saying, I'm sorry.
Oh no, it's just that was one of the true parts of our storyline and the fact that we were good friends. We still are to this day.
Yeah, Brian's amazing. Like I said, I had him on a radio show a few years ago before he was in WWE. I think it's between transitions, his first time and his current time. And him and Paul London, man, they had some pretty crazy alien stories and stuff. Like it was crazy having them. I had one on one show, one another, man. And they were talking about aliens and how the world and you know look what's happening now. It's like maybe they were predicting something. Who knows? You know, because now they just acknowledge UFOs, I think, for the first time a couple days ago. But it, on the radio, they were talking about all that stuff. It's pretty crazy. Yeah, Brian Kendrick is a great story as well. I'd like to get him on here one of these days, but I don't know with contracts. But let me ask you, so speaking of Brian Kendrick and people like that, when you started going into obviously you've done all the, you know, you started doing all the companies we mentioned earlier. So that brings me to, like, the WWE Cruiserweight Tournament. When you first were you under contract when the tournament started? Did you end up signing a contract before the tournament started? Because I thought I heard something that originally you were the winner of the tournament. If people don't know, you were the original, what do you call it, the first cruiserweight champion of the modern generation. You won the tournament.
Yeah.
And so what can you tell me about the tournament? Maybe stuff that maybe people didn't know, you know?
Well,
great tournament, by the way. Amazing.
I wasn't under contract until after, God, it was like the first pay-per-view after my first defense, Clash of the Champions. Like, not until then was I under contract. So it's kind of weird. I could have, like, Medusa'd it if I wanted to.
But
I wasn't under contract until a while after, like a week after or so. So, It was a fun time. It was weird. I didn't really plan on staying. I had the foresight to know that it was going to be a generational thing, like something that like I knew it wasn't going to be the Mae Young Classic, if that makes any sense. Like Mae Young Classic hadn't been like mapped out yet, or it wasn't really a thing. I knew that they had an idea for it in the pipeline, but like I knew that it wasn't going to be something that they keep repeating. It just felt special. Like it was going to be like a J-Cup, you know, like it wasn't something that they were ever going to see again. So I thought, okay, this would be good to do, but I just didn't know if I really wanted to be in WWE at the time. To be honest, I didn't know if I wanted to be there the entire time I was there, I did spend a few years, but it kind of took Regal like talking me into it. I did the tournament and they made me an offer during the tournament and I turned it down initially, or didn't turn it down flat. I just kind of said, I don't know about this right now. I just kind of want to think about it. And I was leaning towards not doing it. I'd been in TNA for a few years and I was in Ring of Honor a couple years before that. And then, you know, Lucha Libre USA for a couple seasons before that. And then before that I was homeless. So, like, it had been a while since I really had either the freedom or the opportunity to go back to, like, Japan and Mexico and do some of the stuff that I really kind of wanted to always do in wrestling. And so I just gotten out of TNA, and I was like, I really want to do this stuff. And I wanted to do Lucha Underground at the time. It was still not a super new project, but, you know, they were just kind of starting to click. and I was like, man, I really, this is something I really want to do. It's unique, and I also want the freedom to be able to go to Japan and do some of the stuff I've been missing for so many years while I was in TNA. But Regal kind of talked me into it and, you know, convinced me to settle down and stay. Reminded me that I'm starting to get a little older. I'm not like a 20-year-old kid anymore. So I took his advice and stayed for a few years and left when it was stopped being fun. But, you know, the Cruiserweight Classic was the start to all that.
Yeah, and now was that intentionally, was it supposed to, you know, the champion, you're, obviously you won the tournament, you end up becoming the Cruiserweight champion. Was the 205 Live, originally that wasn't supposed to be the show for the Cruiserweight Championship. Was that right, or how was the transition from you being a champion? Were you supposed to be on Raw, SmackDown, or? Because I know it eventually ended up on 205, so I'm just curious on that.
We were always supposed to be part of Raw, and I think that was going to be their way of, like, because the company was getting so big, I feel like they needed to try to think of unique components to separate between Mondays and Tuesdays to make sure that the shows were unique but not felt like a repeat of the previous or next show. So, like, you know, they wanted people to watch on Monday and not think, I'll just watch on Tuesday and it'll be the same show, just some different characters, that's all. And they didn't want people to watch on Monday and be like, I don't really need to see SmackDown. I watched wrestling this week. So, like, how could they differentiate between the two? So, like, you know, SmackDown was, if you noted, I mean, this is sort of a nuanced thing, but if you notice, it's even filmed a little differently, at least at the time. Like, they had a different camera angle for it. Like, the hard cam was a little bit more dynamic on SmackDown than it was on Raw. Raw felt more like a tentpole show. SmackDown felt more dynamic. I felt like they separated the characters in such a way that you felt like you couldn't skip one as opposed to the other. And I think, you know, having Cruiserweights on Raw was like their way of keeping Raw not super traditional, because the way that it was had kind of always been over the years was SmackDown had the more exciting wrestling. A lot of, like, SmackDown was more of a wrestling show. Like, if people know, like, the Eddie and Ray generation and Kurt coming in, like, SmackDown felt more like the action show. And so it had always been the more progressive show, both in, like, the action and, like, the characters. There was always a more, like they had different, a lot more representation, I felt like, on SmackDown than they always had on Raw. But Raw always felt like the traditional show. And I think that was their way of saying, okay, this is a new age concept being Cruiserweights. This is something newer and, you know, theoretically exciting that we're going to put on Mondays to keep it, like, help them catch up in the, you know, in the sort of gray areas that SmackDown kind of knocks it out of the park. So it's just their way of, adding that component. But I want to say, like, halfway through the Cruiserweight Classic, they had told us they knew at that point that they really wanted to do a Cruiserweight show. Obviously the network needed to round out its lineup, and they didn't have, I mean, obviously they had endless content historically, but they wanted new content put on there. So, you know, there was that. So we kind of knew for a while, we didn't know it was going to be called 205, but we knew that they were going to have, a Cruiserweight show, like, I don't know, by about round 3 or 4, we knew that there was going to be a Cruiserweight show dedicated to us. We didn't know about the title literally, like, that last day. That we found out about that, like, that day. And I physically didn't see the title until Triple H came out and did that. I didn't even know he was coming out.
Funny thing is, I mean, there's a couple guys on there, like, let's say, like, Buddy Murphy, guys like that, man. They did not look like they were below 205.
A lot of them, you know, but a lot of them for sure were not. They just, they just didn't know what to do with them. For whatever reason, they really weighed us, and I didn't understand that. They could have just not.
Did they really
weighed us? And, yeah, so it was weird because, like, guys like for example, like, Cedric failed to weigh in every time. Like, he's a heavyweight. He should be. He always should have been a heavyweight. He's
about 230, right?
I don't, maybe. I mean, 220 for sure, but he had to really
definitely not 205.
Work hard. I mean, he would try really hard to stay at that 205 line, but I mean, it was just impossible for his body type to do that. He would really work hard to kill himself. He was my road brother, and Oh. And I mean, it was tough, but
he's a good guy, man.
U.S. champion, anyway. Yeah, I was like, you're dead.
Oh, totally.
I was like, this is God's way of telling you should be like the Intercontinental champion instead. So.
Something, yeah. I always loved
go win the U.S. title. And
yeah, who was some of your favorite opponents? I mean, there was guys. I remember your matches with Rich Swann and Brian Kendrick, all these guys. Who were some of your favorite opponents? I mean, it seemed like all of you guys got along, and it seemed like it was a great crew on the 205. Let me say one thing, and this is my opinion, because I've watched 205 live at a live event when they've come to my town or whatever. I always thought the cruiserweights or the 205 didn't get what they deserved, in my personal opinion, because not only – I mean, it was filmed on Monday night. I don't remember if it was filmed on Tuesday or Monday at that point, but you guys were the last – everything already happened, and then they put 205 last. So people already burnt out of watching 2-3 hours of Raw or SmackDown, and then they have to watch 205. So I thought that it didn't give you guys great representation when you could have had, great representation. You know what I mean? So I always thought you guys could have been a little earlier and maybe get the crowd popping, whatnot. You guys end up being the back part of it. I don't know if that was still doing at the end, but anyway, go ahead.
I mean, yes or no. Because there were sometimes, because of logistical reasons, they would tape us at a different time. Like, I remember one time we taped before Raw. So we were the first
to tape that week.
Normally we would tape after SmackDown. So we're like the last of the content after two shows of the week to be taped. But one time I remember we were in a wrestling town. I think we were in Philly. We taped before Raw. So we opened a show in Philly, a wrestling town, and, lively town for – and they still did not care. So I don't think the schedule
I didn't know
really
that.
I don't think the schedule really dictated. I think it's just the fact that fans could see that we're segregated from the rest of the company. Like, it programs fans to know that we don't matter. So
yeah.
If we don't matter to the company, we don't matter to them. And that's just the way it was always going to be. Segregation is what killed us. Like, because they moved us around. Sometimes we taped before SmackDown. And it didn't matter. We would tape after SmackDown. We taped, like I said, before Raw the one time. And
we would be
in wrestling towns or small towns, big towns, whatever towns. And, every now and then we might get a little bit better reaction, but nothing significant that would suggest that the schedule was the difference maker. I mean, the reality – and a lot of people were, like, in denial about it. Like, you'd be in the locker room and they would kind of share that sentiment. Oh, if only this or if only that, or they sounded a little bit louder tonight. It's like, no, dude, like, they don't, and they don't care. The reason why is because we're separate, and that's just – it's going to take breaking that wall down that work. And as you could see, Lucha House Party was really the first to do it. And they got a role on Raw to really kind of just mix in with the other tag teams. And obviously Leo Rush was kind of brought in, not necessarily as a cruiserweight. He was kind of a mixed character in that way. He was multiple purposes. And those guys really were, I think this is a perfect demonstration that just being able to mix in immediately makes you become interesting to the fan base. Now it's like you have Gulak and Brian tagging, and it's just like, it's like Gulak was never even a cruiserweight, because that's all it takes is just being able to have that sort of camaraderie and interaction, and it makes all the difference.
Yeah, no. And I see that now. See, I don't go to a lot of house shows. That's when it was a TV taping. That's what I meant. Mentioned I saw 205, was last. So that makes sense now. Because correct me if I'm wrong, weren't they going to have 205 as their own show? I know it was their own show taped, but weren't you guys going to travel and do smaller arenas? Was that part of 205 or is that another part? I thought I heard that.
Yeah, we ended up doing one house show loop by ourselves. We did our own 205 loop in the Northeast. So we're in a good area for wrestling, because we ended up doing, we did Boston or Lowell, the I Lost My Smile venue for, it was a lot of the old Raw arenas from the early 90s. So we did the I Lost My Smile venue. We did, I think, Poughkeepsie. And then I think we were going to do Manhattan Center, maybe something like that. There were three of those Northeast area things we were going to do for these house shows. So they weren't too terribly big. It was in a wrestling market, and an old school market for WWE, like places that have been loyal to the company for decades, right? And
yeah.
Our pre-sales were so low that they ended up canceling the third of the 3 dates, and we only did the first two.
Oh,
and
that's too
and
bad.
It just wasn't. It was never going to get off the ground that way. Yeah.
Yeah, that's too bad because that would have been fun. You know, ECW had those smaller venues and they were huge, but you know different times, different results. Unfortunately, like so, what was back to what I was saying? What was some of your favorite opponents in 205? And what can you say about some of those guys that, you know, what people might not know? I mean, because there's some amazing talent on 205, so.
Yeah, I mean, I really, like Brian, obviously, because we go back so far, and I like Brian's mind. Like, he's the type of guy that I could kind of just get in the ring with him. And I mean, with anybody, I could kind of just get in the ring and go. But with Brian, it's really comfortable because we think very similar. Swan, obviously, we were really actually roadmates and you know, the whole best friend story with that, like, was pretty true. I mean, we were always, before and after Raw in the same hotel room, same cars, playing PlayStation and stuff every day. Lucha House Party was another, I really liked. And with them and, like with Jack Gallagher, for example, like being a technical wrestler, like I used to tell Jack all the time, we did some house show, like regular house show loops together, like on Raw when I was like champ or like just got out of being champ. So I was still kind of like that top like person like in the division. And I remember doing some of those loops with different opponents. I remember when I had Jack for one, it was like, I would tell him like, dude, like I you're so easy for me to wrestle just cause stylistically I'm a fan of that generation of like what he's trying to emulate, so, and in a lot of ways,
yeah.
I think I kind of helped him along because I knew what he was trying to accomplish, but he couldn't quite put it together exactly how he wanted to have it. So I really liked working with him during that time, and Lucha House Party, obviously, because all those guys are probably my best friends in WWE and like stylistically, obviously, like Lucha Libre is like, that's my jam. So
Yeah.
Those were some of the guys that I really liked. I got to do a special match with Nakamura on NXT. We main evented one of the NXT tapings right before he went up to what was it, Raw, I think, is where he went. Maybe SmackDown. I can't remember where he went. And he and I go way back. We were in the same Young Boy class in New Japan, so I've known him for a long, long time.
Oh, that's cool. Now, is that televised? Can you find it online?
Yeah.
Or is it not?
I don't remember which I guess episode it would be of NXT, but me versus Nakamura is definitely on the network. I think I just saw it the other day.
I have never seen that. That would be cool to check out.
Yeah.
So let me ask you. So obviously, your Cruiserweight champion, your contract is, ending. I think like you said, it wasn't fun anymore. But before your contract ends and whatnot, did you ever actually able to compete at WrestleMania? Because I always ask people what was one of WrestleMania moments. Were you able to actually compete at WrestleMania? I wasn't sure how your contract worked. If you were, I know you were there.
I was there. Yeah, I was there for two, but I didn't do other than just access and some of the side events. I didn't ever do the main card. No.
Oh, okay. That's because I was one, and I had a feeling about that. I was like, man, I thought you were supposed to be one time when it was supposed to be a champion and was going to have a match there, but I don't, how it goes. You hear things, but you don't know what's true.
So
for
the first one that I was there for, the Orlando one, I think I was 33. It was not that long after we were introduced and not that long after I'd lost the title. So we weren't sure who was going to end up being the champ at the time. So there's a chance I could have won it back, and they didn't really know what direction I think they were going to go with it. And I remember some of the production crew, we kind of brainstormed a WrestleMania entrance for what would fit my aesthetic just in case, that was the case. But it ended up being, with Aries and Neville, cause Aries needed a way to debut. So they were debuting him for that period of time. And then I ended up sliding into that spot with the three of them going forward after that. But there's a chance I was going to be in that spot or like in that match. And I remember that we brainstormed a possible entrance idea, but it didn't end up happening. But I don't know. It doesn't really matter. I never really like aspired to have a Mania moment. Like when I was growing up, I wanted to do the Super J Cup. I wanted a J Cup moment. I didn't really care about WrestleMania as far as like, it was never like on a bucket list for me. So I didn't really like, for me, it was just another show.
Oh yeah. So it wasn't too bad. I mean,
you kind of want to do it to like, make all that money, I guess, but
yeah, I heard there's a bonus. I heard there's some bonuses and stuff when you do it, but I wasn't sure.
I'm pretty sure I got a bonus anyway, just for being present for the weekend and all that. So I guess it doesn't really matter.
There you go. Hey, so were you part of the creativity of your entrance videos or your entrance music, whatnot? You know, I mean, you had some of the best. Some of the best intro. Titantron videos, because I know you're a huge video game. You love video games and gaming and whatnot. So were you able to have creativity on your intros?
Yeah, actually all of that was pretty much all my brainchild. When I finished the CWC, CFO Money called me at home one day before Clash of the Champions when I was going to defend for the first time. And they called and asked like, hey, we're going to be arranging music for you. What do you like? Do you like the entrance music you had in CWC? And I said, no. I mean, it's a fine song. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just not really me. It's very like Florida rock, you know, and I'm not really into like alt rock, like in that way. I'm into like, you know, I'm into a lot of stuff. That just happens to be one thing I'm not that much into. I remember telling them I really wanted to create this aesthetic of like Scott Pilgrim and like what people see now with like Ready Player One, stuff like that. That's what I wanted to create. Before I could tell them that, they just said, okay, well, if you don't like your music from before, give us some of what you do like and we'll put something together. And I gave them the worst list of all time. Like, it is like I didn't understand what the exercise was. So I was like firing off this list of stuff I like, but it was like Elvis, Tupac, Ella Fitzgerald, Chuck Berry. And I mean, it was Blink-182, Nirvana. Like, it was stuff that didn't go together at all. And so they got this list of like, you know, 5 to 10 things that I liked, all completely unrelated, spread over like 6 different genres. And then they were like, okay, well, we'll see what we can do. And it was like, I don't know, 10 minutes later, I was like thinking to myself, this is that they can't do anything with that. So I called them back and I said, this is what I want to make. Can you just recreate Wily's Castle from Mega Man? And they said, yes, we can do that. So they did it. And then I explained to them, I want to have this like Scott Pilgrim type of feel. And then I went to the production guys at Raw, because I got to go to TV before I was going to wrestle. And I spoke to those guys about like the Tron and the video and said, can you make it look like Marvel vs. Capcom and Street Fighter and like, you know, the Mega Man power bars and stuff like that and like little power-ups on the ramp like Super Mario, like, you know, mushrooms or like cherries or stuff you would see in like Zelda, like those type of things. And they mishmashed a lot of that generation of retro gaming together and just, you know, killed it. They just came up with this cool aesthetic and I said, perfect, this is exactly what I want. It all kind of came from Gulak, actually. We were sitting around in the middle of the CWC, and we were watching some of the other matches while we were sitting in the theater at Full Sail. And he was asking what I thought of my match. I thought it was okay or whatever. I didn't really care that much through the tournament. I just wanted to do it, do a good job, and just kind of be done with it. And he was telling me, he's like, you look so cool when you're wrestling. You look like a video game character. Like if we were all in a video game, you would be the character I play as. Like I look like a real life Street Fighter character or something. And I remember talking to Claudio another time. I guess everybody knows him as Cesaro.
I knew him as Claudio, but yeah.
Yeah. So we were relating to each other how we get criticized a lot for being too, like we look too kind of perfect the way we move. And like, he and I both get the same criticism, like we need to kind of dirty it up and make it look harder when we wrestle. And event, and Claudio Cesaro had told me, he's like, at a certain point, I just said, you know, screw it. I'm not taking that advice. I'm going to be how I am. And if it looks too perfect, it looks too perfect. I don't care. And I said, you know what? That's a good point. And so I just stopped caring about that and just decided that, you know, like, that's not the worst problem to have. Muhammad Ali had that problem. Like, it looked, boxing looks too easy to him. He just, you know, he floats like he's on air. And I thought, you know what, if that's what my problem is, that's a unique problem to have. So I was like, if I look too perfect, I look like a video game character, then that's what I'll be. And so that's why I created that.
Well, yeah, no, and you know, when I watch you, you are definitely very, very smooth in the ring. And you can tell you've been doing it for a long time because you've obviously, skills. You taught a seminar for our school. It's called the Kayfabe College. It's a school ran by the Ballard brothers and myself. And you did a seminar, and all my students and visiting students really loved your opinion and your, you know, obviously your advice and what they, you know, you gave them. So I wanted to ask, what kind of advice would you give up and coming wrestlers?
You know, it's tough because this is also one of the reasons why it took me so long to start teaching like day camps and stuff like that, because, you know, it's one thing to help out in the gym when you can see people semi-regularly, because you can kind of like help them and there's progress involved, you know, but when you see somebody for an afternoon and you may never see them again, it's like, how can I possibly encapsulate something that can be important to you within 2 hours that can change you going forward? And in a way that I don't need to keep tabs on you and continue to help you. You know, that's why before I would never do like clinics and seminars and stuff like that. But, you know, you start to, I guess, you know, getting older, you start to realize what's more important. And honestly, the best piece of advice I ever received, and it's an old saying in wrestling, but the only thing that's real is the money and the miles. And I think that's really great advice because it puts everything into perspective for you. Like, you know, you everything I've come to find getting older in wrestling is about efficiency. You want to cut out crap that just doesn't matter. Stuff that's only for you that's, like, sort of selfish and just doesn't matter in the grand scheme. Like, what's most important? At the end of the day, like, you're trying to earn a living and you're trying to do well at this. That's the only barometer you have if you're doing a good job or not, is if you're able to make money doing this and take care of a family. And how much wear and tear you put on your body, which, you know, like how many miles are you willing to put on to accomplish that? So it's like, that's really the only thing that's real. Everything else is, you know, arranged for you in some way.
Yeah, definitely. No, that's a great, piece of advice. Hopefully someone, you know, and that's the little things that people might, you know, that's an easy quote to kind of remember, you know, or not a quote, but you know what I mean? You know, and that's a great little observation. So let me ask you, I think I was mentioning it, or I told you about it before we got on the air. We have a little segment on our show that I mean, so far it's a huge hit. We used to do it years ago and it was a huge hit, and we brought it back, and it's basically called
Rib for Your Pleasure.
And so what it is, if you're listening, first time listening, basically it's Rib for Your Pleasure. It's basically a segment we like to, the person calling in, the star of the evening, the best prank we call a rib in pro wrestling that was pulled on you or you pulled on them that you could speak about. Or if that has never happened, something that maybe you heard that was pretty funny that you've always remembered.
Gosh. Well, there's a lot I remember from back in the day that is wouldn't fly as much now. So I'll probably keep those ones to myself because those are pretty crude and kind of hurtful ones that I would witness back in the day when I was younger. But I don't know. There's some good stuff. There's some funny stuff. I mean, there's a lot of guys are a lot of fun outside the ring for different reasons along those lines. Like, I remember one of my favorite things during the mid-2000s, TNA era, the X Division, Sanjay Dutt was great with prank phone calls. He probably still is. And one of my favorite things was rushing to finish whatever we had to do, pay-per-view, whatever, and it was like it wasn't even about having like a banger match that night. It was like, let's get through this, I guess, banger match, but so we could hurry and run back to the hotel, back to the DoubleTree, and prank phone call people. So Sanjay was great at this, and it wasn't just the boys either. He would prank phone call anybody. Like, he prank phone called, it was like Southwest Airlines maybe, or some airline. He prank phone called them as Dracula, trying to book a flight to Transylvania with a non-vegetarian flight. And
that is awesome.
It was so great. We would just do this for hours after different shows. And he would get a lot of the boys. He would call as like a radio show host and act like he was randomly picking like phone numbers, and that you won some kind of contest and you're live on the air, and it was just so funny. There's ones like that. There's a lot of in-ring ribs that were really good that I used to think were pretty funny, that I used to like. One of the ones, you'd have to have multiple guys, and we would kind of trap a guy. You'd have to do it with a partner. You'd trap a guy in the corner, and you progressively start unlacing one of his boots as the match was going on, so eventually you get him to the corner, and you tie his boot to the bottom turnbuckle, and then you try to send him across the ring, and they Looney Tunes it right on their face. There's little ones like that were always kind of funny that we used to do back in the day. There's games that we would like to play. I used to like doing this one, like putting names in a hat of like just classic characters and people that you like. It doesn't even have to be wrestling. It could be anything. It's Frankenstein, whatever. You put these names in a hat, and everybody picks one. And throughout the night, you have to portray that character in some way, and people kind of, the other guys in the locker room have to guess who you got. So you could be Lex Luger, or you could be the monster from the Blue Lagoon. You don't know. Like, you have to portray that somehow during battle royal or anything, just at some point. There's little things like that that were fun to do.
That's pretty funny. Like, so yeah, that's what this segment's about. It's funny stories. I mean, that they don't really get to hear all that too often. So we like to do that every once in a while. Like every show, we try to, even if it's one little quick story. Hey, so you mentioned video games, a little while ago. Obviously, that was your intro and everything. I know you love video games. Did you ever do any of those tournaments? Didn't they used to have tournaments like during WrestleMania time with like Xavier Woods and all that? Were you part of that kind of
thing? Oh, God. I mean, it's just going on year round all the time in the locker room. You go in there at Raw or SmackDown, and there's 3-4 different PlayStations or Xboxes set up in the locker room on monitors, and guys are just always bringing their own equipment, setting it up, and all. I mean, it's like, it's funny because it sounds so childish, but really all it is like video games took over poker in the locker room. Like, guys don't play cribbage anymore; they play Madden. You know what I mean? So it's like, you don't read the newspaper in the locker room. You read Twitter and Instagram. Like, that's the sign of the times. So
yeah, it's just like, everything like evolves.
All night long, guys are, playing NBA 2K and pausing it, going out, doing their match, coming right back, picking the control up, and finishing their game against whoever.
Well, I guess
so that's usually
something like that kind of keeps you out of trouble, That's a good thing, go to the bar.
For the most part, we're addicted to video games and Instagram selfies as opposed to like doing lines of coke and H bombing guys. Like, so
yeah,
that's a lot better than
least,
it was in
that's
the 80s,
that.
I guess. Yeah.
So that's cool, man. Like, yeah, that's good to hear. At least, I know a few some of my younger guys. That's they're all about the video games. I have a Nintendo, if that helps. No, I actually have one of those like little small Nintendos, whatever they're called, the classic, the Nintendo Classic, and I had one of my guys actually doctored up. So I have like 600 games on it. It's pretty awesome, I'm real happy with that. That's
I got one of those too. So yeah, that's awesome. Like, to have it like loaded.
Yeah,
up
they're awesome. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Hey, so you got so with WWE, you said you weren't having fun anymore. So what led to your release? Like, you asked for your release, correct?
Yeah. So the way that it ended, it was kind of a long process. Like, I don't really believe in quitting stuff. So I never just outright quit. I mean, I told them I would quit eventually. So, I mean, that you kind of know that both sides know that, like, at a certain point, like, let's just kind of call it where it is. But I told him for like a year I wasn't happy and I wanted to get back to doing like what I was in the cruiserweight tournament, which is kind of representing Asian Americans and being representing my culture more and being able to do not just the stuff like on the show, but like just like outside of it too. Like with WWE as an engine, I felt like I could do a lot for the community. Like, I mean, obviously I was doing a lot on my own, but it would be different to have that engine behind you, because then, you know, that engine can kind of take the community and help it find platforms that it wouldn't otherwise find. And it's also good for the company as well. And so, you know, I told him, I remember telling Vince a lot, like I would knock on his door and kind of pitch things to him. But I told him at one point, look, I don't think I'm a commodity anymore. I'm wasting your money and I don't want to do that. And yeah, I'm a good wrestler, but everybody in the company is a good wrestler. All of them are, you know. Rusev is a good wrestler. Miz is a great wrestler. Cesaro is a good wrestler. Every single person on the roster is a great wrestler. So doing that doesn't make me unique. And I felt like what did make me unique was representing what I did when I was coming up. But once I got to Raw and as we went on, they separated me from that because they kind of just didn't understand it. And I told them I would like to be to that, like what, you know, Eddie and Ray were to like Latinos and Hispanics and like that to me. And we worked on, like, I remember telling that to Vince in, like, London, like, a year before I left. And he said, okay, well, how can we use you better? And I said, okay, I'll show you. So I put together my own appearances for a while, did some red carpets and just all, like, Filipino and Asian events and things like that. Like, worked out with Pacquiao and got, like, some press and put all this stuff together. Found, like, little, like, influencer communities that wanted to work with WWE and like some Filipino groups that would do like heritage nights for like the NBA and like NFL for like, you know, Filipino athletes that were like on like the Golden State Warriors or whoever. And so they would do giveaways at events and have like local businesses that would like, you know, of like Asian descent or something like that, like just to kind of like little booster things that kind of would work both ways. And then they could do like group sales for like ticket packages, and it helps out everybody involved together, and brought it to Vince. And then he was like, okay, great, well, let's think of a story and think of where to put you. And I think his idea was like, we need to kind of move you to like Raw or SmackDown, and we were aiming for Raw. So he's like, let's like pitch some ideas and we'll see what we'll come up with. So I wrote for like everybody. I wrote tons of stuff, like just for me to be able to work with anybody, gender, fan, whoever. Just I wrote stuff for everybody. And none of it was something that they really wanted to do, something that he felt like was a good fit. And I had already told like the office and told Vince, like, look, I'm not really having fun anymore. This is why I told him like a year before that, like, I'm not having fun anymore. I want to be a commodity for you. I don't believe in quitting, but I do want to not waste your time. So if I'm not going to be doing well here, if I'm not going to be doing anything new, if I'm not going to be a commodity, then, like, I'd like to go back to Japan, go back to Mexico, or do, like, some of the things that are more passions to me. And so, you know, we tried for a year, and then when it kind of reached the point where they didn't really know what to do, I had already sort of volunteered myself to not want to be there. So they said, well, we don't want to make you unhappy, so, you know, we'll cut you loose and do whatever you want to do. And that was pretty much it. I mean, I just wasn't having fun. I didn't necessarily quit, but they kind of knew that I would be quitting if that was the case. And since that ended up being the case, I said, okay, go ahead.
Now, did you ended everything on good terms? You still good terms with them?
Yes.
Okay, that's good. So, that, you know, it's weird because I'm not really trying to set this interview up. I'm just kind of, you know, doing what I do, I guess.
Flying through it.
And it's actually transitioning into what I wanted to talk about every time, which is good. It kind of reminded me because I do the Micromania shows, which are the midget wrestling shows, and we recently did a couple years ago, we did Minnie Mayweather versus Minnie McGregor. It was huge, you know, which set up before that was Minnie Mayweather versus Minnie Pacquiao. Well, in Hawaii a few months ago, we did Minnie McGregor versus Minnie Pacquiao. And Pacquiao, a lot of Filipinos are in Hawaii, you know, a lot of Asian descent, like you said, he's in Hawaii. It was huge. It was huge. And same with McGregor, even though he was, you know, Irishman, I mean, it was huge. So we're actually – there's rumors going around, possibly at that new stadium in Vegas, Pacquiao versus McGregor, which would be huge, you know, for everybody, so including myself with the Micromania thing. So how was it? What recently? I don't know if it was
this year or it was last year, but didn't you wrestle for the first time in your home country of the Philippines? And how was that experience?
Yeah,
because I think of I think of Great Khali, and this guy is like an icon in India. The guy's crazy, like a president there, you know. And I wanted to ask how your opinion, how you were taken, I guess, in the Philippines, knowing that obviously that's your character, that's you. How was that experience?
It was last year, last fall is when we had the event, but I had two trips there. I'd went earlier in the spring, and then I came back in the fall, and that's when we had like a little media tour and then the event at the end of that media week. And when I first initially went in the springtime, it was interesting because, I don't think that I have this presence where, like, I'm well-known or anything. But obviously I do represent them, and I've been on, like, you know, some pretty big platforms. So I didn't think I was maybe, like, a total stranger. But I didn't really think that I was necessarily anything important. But, like, you know, we would have, like, if people would check on, like, their Instagram and they would kind of get wind of where I was going, we would have a lot of people showing up at, like, restaurants or, like, lobbies of, like, hotels or something I was, like, staying in. And kind of like stopping me. I got stopped at the airport a lot. One of the more unique things, I've never had this happen. I've never seen it happen either. It was when we were coming home. I boarded my flight in Manila to come back to America. We were going back to LAX. And I had boarded the plane in Manila. And a flight attendant came back onto, or gate agent rather, one of the gate agents, came down the jetway onto the plane and stopped the flight from taking off. And they asked me to come back out. And I know that one other person from my, like, tour party, I don't want to say, like, entourage, because that sounds like a total, like, you know, jerk thing to say. But, like, I was traveling with a group, and another member of the group had been called off the plane. And I thought maybe they left something at the gate, like a sweater or something, and they just, you know, something like that. Like, they left their luggage or something.
Yeah.
They forgot. And they got called off the plane, and then after a few minutes, I got called off the plane. And when I came back out, all the gate agents in the terminal had gathered at the gate, and they all just wanted to meet me. And they had asked – they had called the other member of my party off the plane just to confirm that it was me that was on the plane. They're like, is that who we thought it was? And then she said, yeah. So then they called me off the plane, and then I spent, like, a while taking pictures with everybody and stuff like that. That was pretty unique to me. I never have had something like that happen before.
And that was on you guys were actually on the runway? I thought I caught the beginning, but you guys already pulled off the gate?
The plane was already boarded, fully boarded, but we hadn't.
Oh, boarded, and
hadn't
shut.
Yeah, we hadn't taxied out yet. They were just closing the door, and they stopped it from taking off, and then they asked me to come back out to the gate, and I went out, and then So we were
about
to start getting on the runway. Yeah.
That's pretty cool because, like, once you close that door, they're not supposed to open it, you know? But,
yeah, usually
that's pretty cool.
That's it. So.
That's cool, man. Like, yeah, that's a cool story because that's something you're always going to remember, you know? And that's like, that makes everything you're doing, in my opinion, I mean, even you probably experienced that years, but that makes everything feel like you've been doing something right this whole time. And just, you know, especially that was your first time wrestling in the Philippines, correct?
Yeah.
Or maybe not that
time, my first, my first time there, like, as an adult. And, like, I think that's when we had the meeting to plan the event for later in the year. It was that time. I remember having the meeting at that time, during that trip. But, I mean, I don't know, like, that experience was unique. I've experienced that before in other places in different forms, like not like with that, with like the plane and like the airport, but like in WWE you get stopped a lot in and out of places.
Yeah.
And, like, I've been stopped in random places a lot, or like have groups of people, like I think that was just unique because it's like sort of like my place, like, you know, going back to the Philippines with like my family being from there. So it's like, you know, if I would do Raw or SmackDown, for example, if we did like the Anaheim Pond or Staples Center a lot of times, like, just people recognizing my car, like, they would stop, or, like, I would stop for them, and then, like, I just gathered around with, like, 200-300 people, and they just, they know that I'm their guy out here, so it's, like, they would stop me and all, like, take pictures, and I'd have some unique video of, like, this crowd of people, like, swarming my car, which is just nice, you know, like, it's heartwarming, I guess, in a way.
Yeah. Well, that's, and, you know, and that's a, when something like that happens, I mean, yeah, like you said, heartwarming. I mean, I'm a huge fan of, like, people that I know, like, I've seen go up, you know, grow, I mean, come up into a business like yourself, or, you know, even like Cubanitos, or just guys like, even like guys like Joey Ryan, and guys like, all these guys are all, we all work together and wrestled in the same place. So I like seeing people like yourself and like guys like Joey and, you know, make it, and I see him on TV because I can say, hey, I know that guy and he's a cool guy, you know. Now, if you're a dick, I want to say shit. But, you know, but there's a lot of cool people. And you yourself, you've always been humble. Bo Cooper is one of my co-hosts for the show on Tuesday that we do. And he told me to tell you hello. And he appreciates you always being that person where, you know, you don't forget where you came from. You're very humble. And you basically you've made a lot of friends like myself and others, and you haven't forgot about that. So he wanted to say hello and thank you for that, you know. We are wrapping up the show.
Tell Bo he's one of my favorites, man.
I will. Yeah, yeah. We do a little show on Tuesday called Vendetta Pro Radio. See, with all the time off and stuff right now, we don't have – like, I'm not on the road with all the midget wrestling and all that, so I figured, hey, let's bring back the podcast and, you know – bring people like yourself and others on the show and, you know, get to hear stories that maybe they didn't know about and get to know you yourself, myself, everybody we bring on. So that's a cool story about the Philippines. Here's a last question or a couple questions left and we'll be done for tonight. But I've been asking this just because we're sitting home doing nothing. So like, what is like a go-to movie for you? Like, it don't matter if you've seen it 500 times, it don't matter, what's a go-to movie that always kind of lifts your spirits? And you, if it's on TV, you don't switch it off. Like, I have a few myself, but like Shawshank Redemption, I never turn it off, even though I know everything. Same with Lost Boys or Karate Kid for me. What are some of the movies that fans might not know, or some of your go-to movies that maybe lift your spirits?
Usually anything horror. And my favorite franchise is Nightmare on Elm Street. Anything horror usually, and then Back to the Future.
Oh, that's probably a good one. Back to the Future is awesome.
Yeah.
Did you actually like that new Nightmare movie that came out a few years ago?
Jack Earl Haley.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. It was like 2000, and it was like about 8 years ago.
Yeah,
did you like that one?
I mean, yeah, I liked it. I thought it was a little bit. The only thing, it was a little off, I guess it should have been, but that's probably why it was meant to be. But it was off-putting for them to be so on the nose about him, the character being, like, children and stuff. Because originally, originally it was like a child killer. And so it's like, okay, that's scary, and that's already, like, you know, edgy enough, but, like, you know, to be like a... like to be like a child molester is like made the character like even like it was like off-putting, like it wasn't even scary, I was just like disturbed, but I guess that's the point. Did a great job as Freddy though. I thought like he's obviously not going to be Robert Englund, but you know, I thought he did a good job. And it was also interesting history because he auditioned for the first Nightmare on Elm Street back in the day and got denied. And so, like, as a bit of, like, yeah, as a bit of trivia, it's pretty cool to come full circuit. I think he was the one that went with Johnny Depp to the audition. Johnny Depp wasn't even really trying to be an actor. He got the role, I mean, as the boyfriend, and I think it was Jack Earl Haley that didn't get the role.
That's crazy.
I don't know if he's auditioning for Freddie or whatever he's auditioning for, maybe just a general audition. But yeah, so all these years later to end up being Freddie was pretty cool, I thought. But yeah, I mean, I liked it.
I didn't even know that story. That's crazy. Like, Bo Cooper works for a company called Trick or Treat Studios, and they make all the really cool masks. They made the latest Halloween mask, and it's a really cool looking it's a real cool shop. So I didn't, and obviously they make really good Freddy Krueger mask, and I didn't know that. But you know, it's funny. It's like I always thought the story was cool. Like even though, you know, the molesting part of it, I didn't really understand. I thought the killing part was better. Like yourself,
I'm glad they explained it too, though. You know what I mean? I thought it was kind of cool. I knew what they were going for. There's only one Robert Englund, but I think the guy did an amazing job. I thought Robert Englund had the better puns, you know, he had the better jokes. That's the only reason I think they were more serious for that one. But it was an amazing movie.
The
you know?
One-liners were better, yeah.
Exactly. So let me ask you the last question. Hey, so were you able to keep the trophy from the Cruiserweight tournament? Or was that a gimmick?
I think I could have, but I didn't. I didn't even ask about it. I didn't want that thing.
I think it's huge, man. You have to pay a bag fee and everything.
They sent me a copy. They sent me a duplicate of the title. I have a title and a trophy case in my office, and that's and the medal. I have the medal still, but that's it. I didn't really want the trophy. That thing is too much.
That's
furniture. Yeah, that's
I was
furniture.
Just going to say that. Yeah, that's furniture.
That
yeah.
Thing. Yeah. The picture is enough.
Yeah, definitely. Hey, so I want to thank you for coming on the show. Like I said, we go way back. Thank you for always being humble. I think a lot of people nowadays forget where they came from. You never did. You've done a lot in the business. I mean, you're definitely someone that people that are wrestling and starting out can look up to. You've done, like, even though you're still really young and you're technically young, but you're not young in a business. You're very experienced. How can people – I know, didn't you recently start a Facebook page? Like, officially, you know?
My manager may have, but you for having me. For everybody that's listening, you pretty much just find me on – I mean, just the two regular socials. You find me on Twitter and Instagram, at MegaTJP.
Okay.
And that's pretty much it. I have a website up, detonationkick.com, and usually would have my touring schedule, but right now I guess there's not much of one.
What was the site again?
Is TJP.
What was the site?
Detonationkick.com.
Destination Kick, or was it?
Detonation Kick. Detonation, like bomb.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, yeah. And then you do have a Pro Wrestling Tees site?
Yeah, just under TJP. Yeah.
Let's hope we get all back to tour, man. It's hard, man, for everybody. And if you have one last thing to say to everybody listening, if not, you know, I appreciate being on the show.
No, just thank you very much for having me, and thank you for listening, anybody that is. And I appreciate it, because without you guys, there's no me. So, you know, thank you very much for following me.
Anyway, thanks, TJ, man. We'll talk soon. Hopefully we'll run into each other. I'll get you on a show one of these days soon, man. Funny thing is, before this started happening, I had a couple shows and lined up, and they've so far. I think you did it with us. You did that King City Fair. So I was going to bring you back for that one. We had a whole weekend planned out, and they just recently started canceling them all. So I'm like, you know, like, I had to hit you up because I knew I had a feeling, and sure enough, they canceled on me about a week ago. So I'm like, I was just waiting for them to tell me, you know, like holding out hope, but I guess it didn't work. But thanks, TJ, for coming on. Good hearing from you, man. Great stories. This is the biggest little show on radio. And TJ, man, thanks once again. We'll talk soon, okay, man?
Of course, brother. Thank you very much.
For sure. Take care. Ladies and gentlemen, that was TJ Perkins. He is, like I said, the first Cruiserweight champion of the modern generation. Good friend of mine, good friend of a lot of people in Southern California. So starting next week, we got on the Vendetta Pro Radio Show hosted by me and Bo Cooper. We'll just say the next week is going to be Five Most Wanted week. If you don't know what Five Most Wanted is, it's one of the most decorated wrestling groups on the independent scene. We have Cody Hawk wrestling for about 25 years. We have he trained Dean Ambrose, Eli Drake, Sammy Callahan, the list goes on and on, including the female wrestler, women wrestler. She's part of the Five Most Wanted. Her name is Shauna Reed. Cody Hawk and Shauna Reed, they're going to be part of the Vendetta Pro Radio on Tuesday. On Thursday, right here at this time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, we're going to have the second half of the Five Most Wanted week with former WWF superstar, True Story, former Chippendales model, True Story, Sexy Sean Casey. He was also a tag team partner with myself. We were known as the Midnight Delight. Also on the show is going to be his head of security, his bodyguard, who happens to also be a former bodyguard of Poison and Bret Michaels, Kid Rock, and now he is the head security of the Five Most Wanted. This is Big John Murray, who was featured on the show Rock of Love with Bret Michaels. All those wrestlers are going to be live on Vendetta Pro Radio, 6 p.m. Pacific time on Tuesday, or the Biggest Little Show on radio, 6 p.m. Pacific time on Thursday. So thank you guys for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Perkins is an amazing talent. I'm glad to call him a friend, like I said. I'd like to end the show with a song. On Tuesday, we ended it with Metalachi, Ace of Spades, which is the world's only heavy metal mariachi band. Tonight, we're going to end it with one of my favorite bands. They're called Steel Panther, and this song is called Party Like Tomorrow is the End of the World.